Welcome to the next installment. This is Amal Sarva. Today I have Hussein Kanji from Hoxton Ventures. One of the people in tech that I've known the longest time, since high school in fact. He tells us about his interesting journey from Stuyvesant High School in New York to California to Seattle to being one of the leading venture capital firms in the UK and Europe.
Hello and welcome to In the Know, my new podcast about doing great things. I'm Amal Sarva, your host from NoCal. And with me I have my old pal, Hussein.
Hi, Amal.
Hi, Hussein. I was thinking of asking you a little bit about all the things that you've done in the years leading up to this moment. From when we met in high school until we started building your venture firm in Hoxton Ventures, roughly speaking. Now, I know you're suspicious, you're sort of wondering what the hell this whole thing's about, but we're gonna spend not a ton of time, maybe 10-ish minutes, and the way I do this one is I try to ask people how to make something great, and in each case, learn a little bit about how I can make my podcast the most important podcast in the entire world.
Okay.
So that's why I'm here. So you're in Munich at the moment.
At DLD.
Yeah, at DLD, in a beer hall. Hussein doesn't drink.
Very Bavarian.
We have some charming German kids running around. So we met in high school.
Yeah.
Talk to us. Where are you from and what's the whole deal?
And we're both from Queens, different parts of Queens. We both ended up in the same school in Manhattan, which is a bit of a magnet feeder school for everybody in New York.
Yeah, so. People know Stuyvesant. I think people know. Do they know in Europe when you talk to them?
Sometimes, if they grew up. And if they have links back to New York, and they vaguely kind of know this school.
Right. And then you were clever enough. Of course, we were on the debate team together, slightly different versions of debate, but you were clever enough to decide to go to Stanford when most of us were doing East Coast things.
Yeah, I just wanted to get away from Stuy people. So,
yeah, there were none there, right?
Yeah, was there like one nobody, almost nobody. There were 18 people who applied to Stanford, 6 who went.
Right.
And which like, is like nothing.
The Ivies, people were like 100
exactly.
From each.
Exactly. Everyone was applying to Harvard. Everyone was applying to Cornell. Mm-hmm. Back then, Stanford was not popular, right? It was very off-piece for an East Coast person. And then that had the good fortune of being in the right place at the right time.
Hey, did you know that? Or you were just trying to go to California?
I was just trying to go to California. I mean, I wanted to less go to California and more not be with all this type A.
So this is 1994, and you were thinking you'll go to some relaxed California university.
So I was looking, where can you get away from all the type A personalities that is kind of the bedrock of Stuy?
Stuy is not
and
for everyone.
Where can you go to a good school, which is not one of the Ivies?
That your parents would be supportive. Your mom's exactly. Like, hey, I've heard of this place. It's okay.
And Stanford's a very good school. I mean, probably more famous today than it was back then. It's still a very good school.
Oh, it's flipped. I mean, it's probably the most in demand and most selective and most whatever. It's probably number one now.
Yeah,
even though your traditional rankings may not. Yeah.
It actually is technically harder to get into now than Stanford.
Harvard. Than Harvard. Yeah.
Than Harvard. Yeah, yeah. And they're more, because there are more applications. So, and then, you know, this is 93. So,
but was tech part of it?
No, I didn't go there for tech. I mean, I knew I probably wanted to do something along the lines of some computer stuff, but it had nothing to do with tech.
But then how did it happen? So how did tech happen to you? Because the next time I spoke to you, because you disappeared as intended from the map of our friends, the alumni, whatever. And the next time I spoke to you, you were working with one of the most famous people in all of Silicon Valley. The media doyen, what's his face, the web development guy,
David Siegel. Yeah. Who made himself a celebrity. I mean, he kind of was very intentional on his part. And weirdly enough, like at one point we knew who Paul Graham was, and Paul was still in Boston doing VOM, which is the
business
that he sold.
E-commerce business.
Yeah, which he sold to Yahoo, because one of his closest friends was one of the folks that we were working with at David's company, Verso.
Studio Verso. Right? You guys were like making websites.
Exactly. So this is the sequence of events is, you know, again, all good timing, although probably not great timing, because the timing would have actually worked in our advantage for a couple of years older. But, you know, NCSA Mosaic.
Right, being a freshman the year that Mosaic came out.
Exactly.
So, might not have put you in the... Same for me. I mean, I had
so
Mosaic.
So Mosaic came out in the summer before we went to school, before we went to university.
Mm-hmm.
And Netscape was formed the first half of our freshman year.
Right, like within a few months. Right, and then by the springtime, like Netscape is taking on Microsoft.
Exactly. So I did an internship in San Francisco. Again, you're a freshman, so you don't know anything, and you know, it's just an internship. So I'm like cycling from Stanford down to the Bay.
You were cycling?
Cycling to the Caltrain, taking the Caltrain before the Caltrain became like a respectable mode of transportation.
Oh, yeah. Back then, like a 90 minute to 2 hour.
It was like an hour to 90 minutes. But you know, and going to South of Market before, or South of Market was like Vietnamese garment workers. And in our building in the summer was Wired Magazine on floor 5.
Oh, that big building, that one.
Yeah, the one on 3rd Street.
Folsom or something?
No, third Street. So one
Organic above. Online.
So Organic was on floor 4. Wired was on floor 5, and Vivid Studios was on floor 3, which is where I interned.
And Vivid was his, like,
no, and so Vivid was, like, one of the early, it was a CD-ROM, interactive CD-ROM type company, which everyone in that industry morphed over to becoming a web designer.
Right, it was multimedia.
Exactly, because that's what the thing was back then. And so I got a little bit of taste for how to do these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And David asked me, kind of when I went back to school my sophomore year, as a second year, to work with him on Verso, which was basically just like Vivid, or just like Organic.
Go with him as the star.
Exactly. And then most of the energy in that first year was writing the book, which we did.
And that became a well-known book. I had the book.
Yeah,
that was him as the star of the internet.
Yeah, but to be fair, I mean, that book transformed the way websites looked on the internet. Right?
What was it called?
Creating Killer Websites.
It's still so memorable.
And what David figured out, like, to his credit, was like, if you used tables, so Netscape had just introduced the concept of tables into web pages. Uh-huh. If you turned the grid on the tables off, you had a grid that was not visible.
Space.
And you could organize space and use that for visual design. And everyone in that web world was using HTML as a mechanism
just to make
tag
a word
information
document.
And to you know, put metadata around it, right. But not to design things. There was no CSS, there's no structured layer to put elements of a page on.
And so the 2D space as like a Photoshop space. It was possibly because of tables. This dude figured it out. Cut up images.
And David has like a fascinating history. Like his aunt was like one of the folks who invented Barbie. And then David went to the Stanford. He went to a graduate program at Stanford and learned how to make typefaces and built the font that McDonald's uses, which gave
them. In their like logo?
Yeah, not the logo. You had your break today? That typeface is called Tecton, and the other one is called Graphite. Gave him an annuity for the rest of his life, and that annuity is going down now. But you know, he was basically made at that point.
So this dude convinced you to drop out of.
No. We did this, and then my third year, we sold the business. Well, we merged the business in with a couple of other businesses, and the whole thing got sold to KPMG.
Because it was a hot digital consultancy kind of deal.
Correct. And then I went to Sun Microsystems.
But you did drop out at that point.
Yeah. So I got a job from Sun somewhere during that third year. Only because I was in this space, I was. I mean, there's not that much a 2021 year old knows, but if the 2021 year old has been doing this for 2 years, most people are just getting introduced to it. The 2021
which is how blockchain sort of has been feeling over
like
the last 18
like
months.
Every new field, right? So you were an expert not because of any innate talent or education, just because you were there early.
Yeah.
It didn't matter that you were 2021. Yeah. So I got pulled into advanced.
Did you have some technology? Content in your studies at that point?
Yeah, I was SimSys.
Oh, you were SimSys.
Yeah, I was SimSys.
Oh, because when I was in grad school, I taught SimSys.
Really? Oh, you taught the philosophy part of it?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
I hated philosophy.
And that's like a famous, right? That was a killer. Yeah, that's like the Enderton book.
Yes.
So you were part of this tribe of like a humanities crossover technical group at Stanford that is famous today. Like so many of the alumni are all doing it.
The program's done really well. Although the program was not designed to be humanities and CS, that's what many of us who did the program were. The symbolic systems comes from an AI term where it was like the rules-driven people were trying to encapsulate the world in symbols, which is not the way we do AI anymore. I mean, the statistical guys have all won, right?
Okay, so then you're at the ATG at Sun, which is another legendary group.
No, Apple had the legendary ATG. Sun had a lot of Apple refugees, a surprising amount of Apple refugees. Almost everyone on my team was an Apple refugee. But it was not the ATG. It was an advanced technology group within Sun. And Sun was always a phenomenally good hardware company, which was selling infrastructure to everybody. It was selling all the machines, all the pizza boxes. everyone on the inside who was a software person knew that this game was going to end because, come on, new hardware would take over and Sun's business model would be threatened. Sun was making, like, printing money in the 90s because every dot-com company bought from Sun.
Yeah, truckload of
and we were the folks in the software business saying, hey, this movie's going to end at some point. But you're saying that and shouting that in the middle of, like, the blockbuster years. Nobody listens to you. So we did that for about 2 years, and we tried to get Sun.
Did you bump into any of the other legends of Sun at that time, like Bill Joy or Vinod or any of those people were there?
No, they were all good. Bill was...
Wasn't he just, like, still, giving birth still, to Java? And
yeah. So Bill was around. Java saw... There was a lot of politics on Sun as well. So Sun was organized as independent companies under one, so they were called Planets, revolving around the Sun, which is Sun. So they were, like, little holding companies. And so Sun Soft, which is a software arm of Sun, which made the operating system Solaris, had nothing to do with JavaSoft, which would have made so much more sense to have JavaSoft be part of SunSoft. Would have made a lot of sense for JavaSoft ended up buying an application server company, which are the middle tier to build web applications. And all of this should have really been on the software side of the SunSoft. I mean, none of this stuff really should have happened, but Sun
that's
being
speaking German. Freud,
So, yes, I spent 2 years there, and it was the people were phenomenal.
This part of your story
is really frustrating.
This part of your story, everything's happening really fast, right? You get to Stanford, you stay for 2 years, you do the Studio Verso
thing.
Fine, you stay for 2 to 3 years at the next thing, and then another couple of years at Sun. And Sun is a giant company. You've never worked anywhere except with David and, like, across the desk from him, and now you're in this huge company working on all these, like, cosmic ideas. And the reason I wanted to get all this background from you, partly because I haven't heard it myself, is because if you skip ahead now from, like, 2000 to today, now you run this venture firm in London. You have, like, 3 of the European unicorns. There might only be, like, 15 total. And you have batched.
The more now. They're 37.
So then 1 in 10 of them is the deal that you did.
That's 37 since, like, 2008. So, like,
that's wild. Yeah. So then how do you get from there where you were at that moment? Because you leave Sun, right?
So then there's this whole chapter where I disappeared for a year in the middle of the dot-com bubble. Like, completely disappeared. I went to Yemen.
Which I still think is a shady thing. Yeah. Yemen hasn't gotten
Yemen's only
more friendly.
It's only worse. It's only got one direction.
Why'd you go? You were just, like, frustrated with everything?
I was frustrated, yeah. I mean, I didn't like the last year at Sun, and I thought, you know, if I wanted to go do something, I wanted to go learn Arabic, I wanted to go do any of this kind of stuff, it's better to do when you're younger.
You thought exactly. It would be a good idea.
And so I did that, and then Yemen became horrendously unsafe right around the time that I left Yemen. And so I left in kind of just in the nick of time. And I went to Yemen because it was off the beaten path, and I would be forced to speak Arabic.
Because you thought Stanford would get you away from people. Instead, it sucked you deep into the heart of the next wave of our society. So then you're like, okay, I'm definitely going to go somewhere weird now.
I had a lot of fun in California, but I just thought if you were going to do something, if you wanted to become fluent in a language, then you want to be in a place where you're forced to speak it every single day. You have no alternative.
Okay, so the intermission happens.
I'm terrible at languages.
You do the intermission.
Yes, so I do the intermission. So I'm getting all these offers to come back, and I'm ignoring them. A year goes by, I come back, and then I catch the bug again and decide to do startup that fails miserably.
What was the startup?
It was a deep packet the name for it eventually, the category became deep packet inspection.
Yeah, right. It had some hooky vibe.
Yeah, so you're opening up packets, looking at the content of them, and figuring out how to class, do some interesting things to them, kind of in at wire speed. That was what was weird about it. That didn't work, so then I joined a friend's company who was building video infrastructure software for in a pre-YouTube era, back when real networks was kind of
is that like Brightcove or something?
No, this is called Radiance, but it was very Brightcove-ish. So it was Brightcove well before Brightcove. And was trying to, you know, time shift a lot of this stuff and use the bandwidth at off hours to, you know, do the caching. It was kind of like Brightcove meets Prime for videos.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I think the entire purpose of this business was to sell the business, probably not to Akamai, which is super smart technically, but to the number two competitor, which is at that point called iBeam, and it was bought by Williams Communications Group. And the founder was a serial entrepreneur in the Bay Area, and I think the reason for this business was to flip it. It couldn't be flipped because the dot-com collapse happened. People just didn't have cash to spend on this stuff. And we were years ahead of YouTube, so there was no video consumption taking
demand.
And so $35 million went into this company, eventually got sold to Comcast, which is a sad story. And then I did another company with one of the angels in there to spin out a research project out of a research lab. It was the machine that you see at airport security, where you put your hands above your head, it's the millimeter wave radar machine. Mike had the good judgment post 9/11 to say, that's an interesting piece of kit. We should be able to turn that kit or that research into a company, and then we can sell this kit to every airport in the world.
Oh, cool. And then we, I guess GE ends up being a big vendor.
L3 bought it. Yeah, so L3 bought it for $135 million, which is pretty good.
Wow, interesting.
They didn't sell very many of them. It took a lot longer for that market to mature, but you see them everywhere today. So more than made everybody back.
Yeah, totally. So that's like five startups in a compressed period with this one, like, Holiday in the middle.
And then I got pulled up to Microsoft. So the guy who invented speech recognition was an SGI exec, and the founder of this video streaming infrastructure company was also an SGI exec. And SGI was the hot company to be in.
Isn't that where Jim Clark came from?
Pre-Netscape, SGI was the company, and kind of post-Netscape, Google was the company. And now they're multi-company.
Facebook 5 minutes ago, whoever it is now. Yeah.
But, you know, there was a time where SGI had most of the really smart folks, and so Kai-Fu was one of them, and Kai-Fu is
Kai-Fu just wrote this big book.
Exactly. So Kai-Fu is now very well known. Yeah, so
the AI superpowers or whatever.
So Kai-Fu pulled me up to figure out and spend some time thinking about how to commercialize speech track. So Kai-Fu's background
was
Kai-Fu.
And was he the guy who's associated with the invention of deep learning?
So not deep learning. He used hidden Markov chains, hidden Markov models, to basically invent the way to do speech recognition, which is we use these statistical chains to figure out what the phonemes are. And it's very similar to how CNNs work today in AI, but it's a little bit as a parallel.
The connectionist networks. Yeah, I mean, that breakthrough was one of the two or three steps that got us to where we are now. Little known fact, Microsoft invented deep learning.
Really?
He didn't quite put it that way. But what he means is the current revolution in AI happened from work at Microsoft. MSR
was it, like, Bill decided to build MSR, and Kai-Fu was very instrumental in putting MSR together. MSR Asia was all done by Kai-Fu in Beijing. MSR has some of the best minds on the research agenda. I mean, it's no different than, like, the digital research team that spun out Alta Vista, which Google ended up acquiring. They hired the people who did that stuff. So I did Microsoft for a little bit, and then I rotated around Microsoft, and then I went to business school a little bit off piece. I went to London.
So what was that? That was another reset.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, I'm not going to stay in this corporate universe anymore.
I didn't want to do the corporate thing. I did Microsoft because universally the feedback I got from everybody was go spend a couple years in a formative product-y type business role. And do something at a real company. And back then, the only softwares of any scale were Microsoft, Adobe, Google, and all this new stuff was still new. I had an offer from Yahoo to go rebuild Yahoo Search, and that team turned out to be a phenomenal team. So Jeff Weiner ran it, who went on to run LinkedIn.
Yeah.
My buddy Kevin, who I recommended instead of me, became the head of product at Zynga. His boss became the COO at Zynga. Ali Dia went on to go found Collective Health and became the head of product at AdMob. There was a whole bunch of superstars in there.
That's amazing. So what happens then is, because you hadn't finished at Stanford, you have to go to a business school somewhere else.
Right.
So that's why you end up at LBS.
Correct.
And then after that, it's all venture. You do this thing at Excel.
Yeah, I joined Excel.
What was the huge, you got like a signature deal out of that thing at Excel. It was a games thing, right?
No, it wasn't, but it wasn't my deal.
You were close to it.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I was on Observer, Playfish. When Facebook opened up its API, I mean, people now use Cambridge Analytica, et cetera, but some people built video games on top of this thing, and that became the signature thing at Facebook. That company that really dominated was Candy Crush, Kingdom Come.
Totally.
And so number two is Farmville, which is Zynga, but the number three behind that was Playfish. And Playfish was an early pioneer, but it got acquired by EA 2 years ago.
Right, and that was a big outcome. And then
it was huge for the fund at that time. That was the biggest outcome.
And it was after that that you set up Hoxton. Right?
Yeah, so Axel changed a whole bunch of stuff in Europe, and they decided to do more growth equity, etc. And it was clear that I didn't really have a permanent role there.
Yeah.
So I asked
asking us if we want more beer, and maybe I will have one.
So I So again, when you have a choice like that, mm-hmm. and you want to stay in venture, there are no other venture funds in Europe that would hire me. So out of kind of pure necessity, and everyone in the Bay Area said you used to be smart, and then you moved to Europe.
Oh, now you're not smart anymore.
Well, we don't know, right? Because why would you leave Silicon Valley to go do something?
I see. Yeah, London at that time was still a pretty small market,
tiny market.
But those couple of, like that Playfish deal was probably one of the huge outcomes of out of London. And then what was amazing to me as we were just catching up before we got started here. Yes, I knew about Deliveroo, where you guys got involved super early. I think you were in the first financing.
Yeah, well,
it's like a multi-billion
not the angel
company.
Financing, but the first venture financing, yeah.
I don't know, the most recent
round. $2 billion
yeah, funds. Awesome. And then this Darktrace thing, I see everywhere.
Which is our even biggest company, and you start to see advertising now at the airports. So we were the first venture investor. We were, to be fair, we're the only venture investor that they allowed in. So they generally didn't like most of the venture community, having built a business before. They were very skeptical venture people.
I see. And you have this like mysterious magic spell you cast from hanging out with Kai Fu and David Siegel and
very specific was it that we had there was this long debate about the quality of another company in the Bay Area, which went public about a year later. At that point, I had already gone public, FireEye. Some folks who I knew at Stanford were working at FireEye, so I knew a little bit about the internals of the company. We got into this big debate about what FireEye did well and didn't do well, and then the founders went off and double-checked a lot of the info I gave them. They said, look, you're actually more connected to California than we thought you were, and some of the stuff that you hear is actually interesting to us. So we actually don't need your money, but we might want to have you around the table once in a while.
So draw a lesson from all this. Like, do you have like a small pieces loosely joined kind of lesson about all these stops and moves and steps?
So I don't think anything career stuff can really be planned, right? So if you're generally around bright people, you're generally around Amuris, right? You will pick up a bunch of stuff and it will be incredibly useful downstream, right? It's like the old classic, like Steve Jobs thing. Like, he had no idea why he studied fonts, and then it turned out it helped him when he was building Mac, right? You just don't know these kinds of things. But I think the two guidelines are be around smart people and be around new interesting things, and stuff just figures itself out. The one lesson I got from other folks, which I haven't listened to, was then be really persistent. Right. So a friend of mine sold a company to Amazon way back in the early, like in the late 90s. So you can learn the early acquisitions. And it was the search engine company that Amazon bought called Jungly.
Oh, yeah.
It was like one of the first Indian success stories in the area. So Ram Shriram was the president, but my friend was the founder and CEO. And he told me that he held on to a stock at Amazon, he'd be a multi-billionaire right now. And he sold out, right? And he knew directionally that Jeff was going to go down and build something phenomenal. He didn't know how phenomenal, but he was implicitly a long-term believer, but he exited and sold. So persistence, I think, makes a big difference. So this, if you do really believe something is going to trend upwards and long-term trend upwards, stay part of it, right, all the way through. Like me going to Yemen in the middle of the dot-com bubble was a stupid thing to do in hindsight, right? Small lessons.
You can use. Or maybe it created the person you are now. I don't know. Because not everyone's a good investor. It's actually really hard to find shit. I've written 100 deals. I don't think any of them is in the order of magnitude of the couple that we just name checked.
Yeah, we've been lucky. I mean, we're also in kind of the right place at the right time, right? Europe is blossoming. And we did 18 $2 billion companies. I think 5 are going to turn out to be $1 billion companies.
That's unbelievable.
And we'll see what happens up to 5.
Thank you, Hussein, for appearing.
Thank
on
you.
One of my inaugural episodes, if you didn't know, even in this noisy
hopefully
beer hall. Yeah, well, that kid is famous, for those of you listening.